In a moment, we're going to be talking with the past National Enquirer's chief reporter of the paranormal, Paul Bannister. He visited 40 countries for the tabloid in search of the weird and the wonderful, and he's bringing it to our program tonight on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. As I mentioned, Paul Bannister was the National Enquirer's chief reporter of the paranormal. Visited about 40 countries for the Enquirer in search of the weird and the wonderful. He broke stories like the CIA's contract to develop and train psychics as spies. And what a story that was. He has covered, oh gosh, all kinds of bizarre stories. He has interviewed Edgar Mitchell, the late astronaut, of course, and our dear friend, God rest his soul. He knows Uri Geller so much. Paul, I'm going to have some fun with you tonight. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, George. It's good to talk to you.
We had a guy involved in the Kennedy assassination by the name of Guy Bannister.
Oh, really? It wasn't me.
No relationship, huh?
I haven't shot anybody recently.
Very good. And your new work is called what? Tabloid Man?
Yeah. Tabloid Man and the Baffling Chair of Death.
Oh, we'll talk about that, too.
That got the librarians licking their lips.
How in the world did you get involved in the bizarre?
Well, I was a journalist in the UK. I worked for the BBC, and I worked for a couple of national newspapers. And a friend of mine, the Enquirer moved from New York to Florida and as a very skeleton operation, and then started recruiting. And a friend of mine was one of the few, three or four reporters who was there in the beginning in Florida. And I bumped into him in Manchester. Now, you've got to imagine, Manchester's a dirty industrial city in the north of England. It was a rainy winter's day, and this fellow walked into the pub in a white suit, open neck white shirt, fedora, and a tan. And I mean, it was like seeing a peacock in a chicken house, you know? And I said, "What's all this, Harry?" He said, "Working at the National Enquirer." So anyway, one thing led to another. I did some freelance stories for them, and when they started to expand their staff about 6 months later, they didn't quite remember me, but I got an interview with them, and I was able to point to a particular story I'd done for them that had made the page one lead. I said, "Well, you know, you can't deny me a chance to try out now after that." And that was the Baffling Chair of Death story.
You know, I was always intrigued by the Enquirer. I would see it, Paul, at supermarkets.
Yeah.
And, you know, the covers always captured you. The headlines, a picture of an alien meeting the president. How much of that was real? How much of that was made up just to grab us?
Well, a lot of people confuse the Enquirer. The old Enquirer was black and white, you might remember, George.
That's right.
But when they went to color, and I can't remember exactly when, probably about 77, they used the old presses and made a million copies a week of the Weekly World News. And that was the paper that got all the attention. That was the one with Bat Boy and, you know, "I use my dead baby's face as an ashtray," that kind of story.
Yeah.
And okay. People confuse that a lot. The Enquirer itself was actually not the celebrity tattle sheet that it is today. We had about 60, 70 categories of stories, and they were how to stretch your budget dollar, how to cure arthritis, life after death, predictions.
Sounds like my radio show, Paul.
Not as good as your show, George. Come on.
Ah, thank you, sir.
No, but I mean, they had a whole spectrum of stories. And the publisher, Gene Pope, General Russell Pope Jr., wanted to make this a good read. And so he went for accuracy. We had medical stories that we take to the American Heart Association or the Arthritis Foundation or whomever to be checked before they went in the paper. The same went for the, you know, the kind of stories I did, which, as I say, I fell into the paranormal. And where we could, we did a full checking on them. I mean, some people obviously cheated, but that has to be said.
Sure.
But we had a research department, and they're headed up by Time Magazine's former head of research, probably 24 girls who listened to our tapes and checked them off word by word with a dot over every word. Of course, I mean, some people cheat, and they would do a read back of a story so that instead of you having the whole interview, they'd say, I'll call you back, I'll read the story to you, and you can approve it if it's real. And then they call one of the friends.
And fake it. Okay.
And the friend said, that's a wonderful piece. You know?
I love it.
So things did get in. Things did get, you know, there were sort of people who took shortcuts.
I mean, they got sued a lot, didn't they?
Not really, no, because usually there was at least a grain of truth in the celeb stories. They were the only things really contentious. I mean, you know, somebody says, well, we found ancient astronaut pictures on the wall in a cave in, you know, in Afghanistan. Yeah. Then who's going to sue?
You know, I agree with that.
No, I think the biggest lawsuit, the one that people always remember, was Carol Burnett. And it was like an 18-word gossip item that implied she was drunk in public. And she made such a fuss, she cried in court and said how it had hurt her because her mother was an alcoholic or something. And got like a $2 million
judgment,
$1.4 million settlement.
Wow.
That was reduced on appeal to like $200,000. And nobody ever heard that part.
No.
And, you know, she didn't. She continued to play alcoholics on her show. So we don't feel she was really as hurt as she might have been.
How did you find your stories that you wrote about?
Well, lots of ways, actually. I traveled with Edgar Mitchell for a few months.
Great guy, wasn't he? I miss
wonderful.
Him.
Ed was a wonderful man. And he was asked, you know, to help us set up some contacts in the world of parapsychology. So, you know, I went to Menninger Foundation with him. I went to Maimonides Hospital to see Onaton and the Dream Lab there. You know, we worked with, he introduced me to Targ and Puthoff, who were doing the CIA psychic spying program.
That's right.
At SRI, the Stanford Research Institute, as you know. He sort of gave me some contacts. We made contacts. I went to conferences. I go to the Institute for
Noetic Sciences
annual conference and go through these huge, thick, volumes of research papers, and looking for one that says, you know, you can read your brain waves. Well, it was science fiction then, but 15 years later, it's real. You know. They're finding that people's emotions can be read from outside the skull. They wear a skull cap with sensors on there, of course.
Edgar was a great believer, Paul, as you know, that we have been visited.
Absolutely.
I asked him many times, and I want to see what he told you. But he always admitted that he never saw anything on the moon, and I believe him. But
no, he didn't. He did some experiments on his way there with Olaf Johnson.
That's right.
I remember that. But he told me a lovely story from White Sands, you know. He didn't see this himself, but he was major in the Marines, I believe, and he'd fly around the country in a fighter jet. And he'd gone to White Sands or something, and they were getting ready to launch some bird, you know, with a satellite, whatever, and had a high-speed camera trained on it. And the camera operator saw something unusual and had the wit to start the camera going. And he showed this film to Ed a couple of days later because he knew of Ed's interest in this. And, you know, as founder of the IONS Institute for Noetic Sciences, Ed was extremely interested. And it was a frisbee-sized saucer that circled its way up the bird, up the rocket. He said like a hummingbird, circling around it, going all the way up to the top, and then just took off at high speed. So Ed saw this with a lot of interest, because, I mean, you know, it's high-speed camera, you know, good quality, all the rest of it. Very, very interested, very intrigued. And he talked to somebody about it, and they went back 3 days later to look at the film, and it had vanished.
Gone. Oh.
Somebody had, you know, okay, we don't really need that out there.
Unbelievable. Yeah, he was with the Navy, by the way. He was a Navy.
Navy, not Marines. Yes, okay. Yeah. I think he was a major or something.
Captain.
Right? Did they have a major in the Navy?
No.
Who knows?
No, not in the Navy.
The Queen wouldn't allow it.
But he was
it,
a captain, which is the equivalent of.
So. Okay. Yeah, but the Queen wouldn't allow it.
But he would tell me, you know, he told me an Uri Geller story, and you know Uri as well.
I knew Uri very, very well, yeah.
Did they ever tell you the tie clasp story that Mitchell had lost, I think it was a NASA tie clasp, a little pin, and he lost it. And he was having lunch with Uri Geller one day, and Geller was eating some ice cream.
Right.
And all of a sudden, he felt something in his mouth,
right.
and he took it out, and it was the tie clasp that Mitchell had lost years ago.
Interesting story.
Weird.
I'll come back to that because I've got something exactly like that. But he was telling me about when Geller was first being tested by Puthoff and Targ. Well, they were doing the remote viewing experiments, as you know. And Geller had sort of, they wanted to see how he would perform, if he could, on that famous orange couch there at SRI. And they'd gone for the evening to, I think, Targ's house in Palo Alto, had a few bottles of wine. And Geller had done a couple of, spoon bending things for them, nothing very significant.
Yeah.
And Ed said he went back to his own car, opened the door, and two bottles of wine apparently fell through the roof of the car onto the seat. He's no idea how they
unbelievable.
Did it.
Unbelievable.
He drove a quarter of a block to the end of Harriet Street where Russell lived. And the a road sign, the pole of the road sign was twisted around in a complete loop. Now you can't say, okay, then Uri did this. But they'd been trying to get these effects, and something happened that night. He did actually say that they'd been trying some experiments, didn't work. They were coming through a lab of some sort, passing a magnetometer, and Geller stopped and waved his fist at it and shouted to it, and the thing stopped working. And it was a big, $250,000 piece of equipment.
He's done stuff like that on the radio show, Paul. He had everybody take their watches and clocks and hold them up to the radio.
Right.
And they started running again. These watches and clocks had been dead for years.
Right.
And they
right.
started running. That was amazing. But the most amazing aspect of what he did was about a year later, we will take some of our programs and rerun them on the weekends as sort of a best of.
Yeah.
And so our producers picked the Uri Geller show I did with him.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, that following weekend, I'm getting emails from people.
Switchboard lit up, didn't it?
Yeah. So my watch is working, and I'm going, what the heck is this? Only to realize, oh, my God, that's the show they picked to run on the weekend. He had the same ability in a program that was on tape to make watches and clocks run. It was unbelievable.
Well, I can totally support your story. I went down to Mexico City where he was living at the time. And we did a couple of these experiments, with the Enquirer. We'd print a picture of Uri in the paper. And then we'd tell readers at a given time on a given day, put your broken watch or whatever on it, your spoons. And I went down to Mexico City with him. And he did his thing. He just came to my hotel room. Actually, we didn't even go to his house. It was very informal. It was just a photographer, myself, Uri. He insisted on giving me more metal around me, more metal. And he got the photographer, fortunately, had some hard case, cases to carry his gear. And he got all these around himself. And then he did his thing, said, right, okay, I've sent it out. And we ran the story. And then we asked for, we'd run the story a week ahead, of course, and then we asked people to respond, and we had 1,100 responses, and about 30 said nothing happened, and then the rest said this happened. There was everything from a rabbi in New York whose garage door kept going up and down for 4 hours, even though they unplugged the motor, right through to a woman in Monterey who was very indignant because she had three expensive topaz rings, quartz, and they'd shattered on the inside. I spoke to the jeweler about that. He said, I don't understand. He said, the surface was totally unbroken, but the inside, the ring had shattered. And there were a handful more of these stories, which I, you know, I'd have to sort of dig around a little bit to recall. But the interesting thing was, a week after we, you know, done the whole thing, some people did the experiment not knowing they'd got the issue wrong. And it all worked for them then, which implies that the ability came from the reader, not from Uri.
Yeah, just Uri was, maybe he was like the facilitator.
So our out-of-date, you know, magazine did the same.
I think he's got some incredible powers. You know, he bombed on the late Johnny Carson show, the Tonight Show.
Yeah.
And that haunted him for a while, I think. But I think he was nervous or something like that.
He was in a gold mine in South Africa, and he bent a crowbar into a U-shape. A crowbar.
That's impossible.
It
right.
absolutely is.
With your own hands, that's impossible.
He took it off one of the miners. I mean, that's not something, a 4-foot crowbar is not something you can conceal up your sleeve. Well, I don't know. I couldn't anyway. Uri did all kinds of things. People like Randy, you know, amazing Randy.
Oh, who hates Uri Geller,
well,
right?
He hates anybody to do with the Ockel, you know. But Geller just had this ability to do it, and to get other people. I mean, I've bent spoons myself, and I went along to spoon bending evening in L.A. one time, but he wasn't even doing that one; it was just somebody else. And I'd taken along my own spoons, and I know I didn't cheat, but it was just a question of just rub it and the general energy. And the one theory I've heard, and you may have heard this, George, is that everything is not solid. Everything is made up of protons and neutrons all revolving in a little pattern.
That's right.
So if you can affect the energy that keeps that pattern, maybe you could affect the shape of the so-called solid object.
I mean, in theory, we're a bunch of molecules and atoms and electrons and neutrons and protons, and we're not connected. But, you know, the particles are so close, it looks like we're solid.
Yeah.
And he probably has that ability to manipulate that.
Very possibly. Well, you remember Jonathan Livingston Seagull? He would sink into the earth and walk on the water.
That's right.
There's no real difference in the theory, I don't suppose.
Have you, when you were writing stories for the Inquirer, did you ever have to pay somebody or buy them off to get their story?
Oh, yeah. Not every day.
No.
But, you know, some people raise an eyebrow and say, well, it can't be a real story if you have to pay for it. But that's not necessarily the case. You know, it's a profit-making enterprise.
That's true.
I've done it for the Inquirer. I've done it for overseas tabloids, you know, for some of the British press. Here's one who might amuse you. There was a big story in Britain about 5 or 6 years ago. A police officer was shot and killed, which is very, very unusual in Britain.
That's true.
Sad. And the killer was actually American, and his girlfriend lived in Ohio. I was sent to frozen Ohio in the middle of the winter to get to the girlfriend and sign her up for an exclusive. She couldn't actually do the interview until after the court case had been heard in Britain, which actually we had to wait 3 or 4 months.
Sure.
So I went up there, and I was told, you know, we'll go to $100,000 for it. So,
my
fine.
God.
Yeah. It was a big story then in Britain. And, you know, when you've got a paper like The Mirror with a 5 million circulation each day, it's not as big a number as it seems. Anyway, I went up there, and her father said, he was a FedEx delivery driver, but he was convinced he was really, really smart. He said, I'm smarter than any attorney, and I'm going to do the negotiations. So I spent 10 days there basically hanging around my motel for him to call, and going up there and pestering him. And he was juggling 3 or 4 different offers. And made a mistake finally of allowing me. I said, look, I've got to prove to my, you know, editor back in London that you're really getting these offers. So he let me photograph the things, although he put his finger across the name at the top. And we were there saying 100,000, and I see he's got 100,000 offered by another rival newspaper.
Hold on right there, Paul. We're going to take a break at this $100,000 offer and see what happens. With our very special guest tonight, Paul Bannister, great stories. And next hour, we'll take some of your phone calls as well. Maybe you can share one of your little stories with us as well on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Paul Bannister is with us, of course. So, Paul, we were talking about the person in Ohio that you had what, offered 100,000, or you were ready to do
that? Yeah, we were ready to offer 100,000. We sort of made a tentative offer of it. And I kept bugging him. There were three papers involved, all rivals, so it looked like we'd have to pay that much. Anyway, he let me see the offers because I said, you know, I can't just take your word for it. So I photographed them, sent them off. Well, the key was that the other papers had offered him something similar numbers, but 30,000 for the first installment, 30 for the second installment of the story, and 40 for the third.
Aha, pieces.
I said, well, you know, what's the guarantee that you're going to get a third or a second installment? And he hadn't thought it through. So in the end, I got it for $40,000.
The whole thing.
The whole thing. And we ran the two pieces, actually. But, you know, the guys, if he just said yes, instead of being smarter than any attorney, I guess he might have done better.
Okay, let's talk about this chair of death. What are we talking about here?
I'm sorry, I missed that.
The chair of death.
Oh, right. One of my lovely stories for me. It's the thing that actually got me started with the Enquirer. They were looking for stories, and that's obviously, you know, that a friend of mine told me about it, and I went up. It's a public house called the Busby Stoop. Stoop was an old word for a gallows. And it's near York in England, northern England. And back in the early 1700s, a fellow called Busby, I think his name is it's in the records at York Assizes, was convicted of murder. He'd murdered his father-in-law, a fellow called Dan Oatey. I think he killed him with a spade.
Jeez.
And he was sentenced to be hanged. And the drill at that time was they'd take them out to the local crossroads and hang them in chains as a warning to everybody else.
And keep them there for a while, right?
They keep the chains would keep your body together for quite a while. So anyway, he had been frequenting this little pub at a place called Sandhutton, and he was a bully, loud, obnoxious man, who claimed the chair by the fire was his, and anybody who sat in it was likely to be thrown on the floor or something. So when he was going to be hanged, in the usual way, they gave him, you know, a last pot of ale, and the hangman wasn't stupid, and he drug it, keep the man quiet, you know. And so anyway, they gave him his pot of ale. He sat in his chair for the last time, took him outside and hanged him. But he cursed the chair, said, anybody who sits in my chair is going to die within 3 days.
Just by sitting there?
Just for sitting in it, yeah. So I heard this story, and the chair got to be, that was quite famous, actually. Numbers of people were reported to have died after taking up the dare. So I went to investigate, and I met the publican, and he told me ghost stories about the place, and he named names and said, well, you know, there was this fellow here, he sat in the chair one lunchtime, and then he got in his car, and he drove 300 yards down the road and hit a tree and died. Then there's a young roofer who fell off the roof the day he sat in the chair. There was a big army sergeant who dropped down dead of a heart attack in Ripon Marketplace. And he named a few like that. And I filed a story, and I thought that'd be good. And the Enquirer came back and said, look, you know, we want more. So I found more. And it ran on page one as the lead, as the battling chair of death. And in fact, that influenced my, as I say, getting the job later. And they sort of saw, you know, he's done a paranormal story, so he can get on to do some more. Well, later I went back to check all this out, and a little bit deeper, And it turned out it really could not have been the curse, because the chair wasn't built or made until the 1860s, 150 years after the event, after the hanging. So, A, Busby couldn't have sat in it, and B, he couldn't have cursed it. But it had been in the pub with a legend around it when they built a World War II airfield right there. A Canadian crews were flying Lancaster bombers out of it during World War II. And a lot of guys would go to the air crew would go and they'd have a pint, and the next day they'd go on a mission and some wouldn't come back. And then the legend grew and grew and grew. And the chair is still to be seen. It's in a museum in a little town called Thirsk near York. And when I sort of found out that it couldn't have been cursed by Busby, but people still believed that it was cursed, so much so that the curator has it hung on a wall and chained up there, and nobody can get into it. And a Japanese TV crew came through to film it, and he wouldn't take it off the wall even for them, in case somebody slipped and sat in it.
Well, but, and the belief is half the battle, isn't
well,
it?
Well, that's the truth. And you might remember the Soviets did some work in the 80s trying to imbue things with evil thoughts and confusion and so on. Kulagina was doing some of this. And so there is a belief that objects can actually retain nasty vibrations. Inanimate objects.
Yeah,
can,
I believe
you know,
that.
Can hold these things.
What was for you one of the weirdest stories you've ever covered in your career?
Whew.
One of those head shakers.
There's a lot. Just trying to think. In terms of importance, I think that the CIA psychic spying was really very good.
Yeah, that is a great story.
How about the what about the old stone house there in Washington, D.C.?
Tell us about that.
Well, it's the oldest building, I think, in North America, in D.C., in Washington, I'm sorry. It was built in 1765 by somebody called Christopher Layman. And it has it's hard to know exactly, but there are reports of 11 different ghosts who hang out there. The most active one, actually, George, I hate to tell you this, is called George.
Oh, great.
He's a bull-like man who haunts the third-floor bedroom, and he's been accused of pushing and strangling women who, you know, the place is...
Definitely not me.
A national monument. What's the word I'm looking for? A national trust?
Treasure?
It's not actually a treasure as such, but it is the oldest stone house, and the oldest house in Washington. And the National Park Service have it. That's what it is. And so they get a lot of visitors to the place. It's a museum. And
historic. We put these on the historic registry here in this country.
That's it. You've got it.
Okay.
But there's ghosts. There's a lady wearing a 1700-style dress, brown one. She's always seen near the fireplace. And there's a phantom of a young woman with ringlets running up and down the staircase. And there's a small boy they call Joey, who runs up and down the hallway on the third floor, and so on and so on and so on. Well, I was doing the story, and I was doing it by phone. And I was taping the conversation. I was interviewing the curator of the house. Her name is Ray Koch. She's not there now, but she was at the time, obviously. And the house is there. It's on M Street, Northwest in Georgetown. And the Rock Creek Park National Park Service people supervise it. And I said, well, let's see. What have you got? You've got, how many ghosts have you got in there? Is it five or what is it? And she started talking straight away, and I didn't have the number right. She, like me, she gabbled on about the different ghosts. And when I was writing the story, I thought, what was that? And I went back to my tape and listened, and a voice pops up, and it says, 4, 2, and a kid. And that actually is the number of active ghosts in the place, 4 men, 2 women, and a child. Well, that voice is on my website for anybody to listen to. You can make your own decisions about whether it's I can absolutely, on my honor, assure you that I didn't fake anything. Ray, her name is, I couldn't have done. She was talking. It wasn't that she invented a voice and threw it into the conversation. And the one of the things about it also, to me, the voice has a Midlands English accent. Well, for the first 150 years or so of its occupation, it was English settlers who lived there in the place.
That's a neat story.
If anybody wants to hear it, you can just go to my website at Bannister Books, and you just click a button, and it's a 15-second tape or something like that.
You've covered UFOs.
Not really, no. No, I can't say that. Bob Pratt, whom you might know or might have known, was the Enquirer UFO man. He did the same as I did, but he was looking at UFOs. And, you know, my best stories are things like, you know, Edgar Mitchell's, you know, White Sands UFO.
Yeah, Mitchell was just great stories. And his belief in telepathy and mind control was amazing, too.
Well, that's right, you know, and he was right. This institute he founded, Institute of Noetic Sciences, Noes is Greek for knowledge, I believe, and he just said, look, we're not limited by what's in our minds. We don't know what part of our minds, you know, we only know a small percentage of what goes on. Now, you talked actually earlier about Edgar Mitchell's brooch, you know, his insignia appearing in his mouth.
Yeah.
Well, I had the same exact same thing happened to me, not with Ed. I was sent to Brazil. I was down in Sao Paulo. There was a house in a little town actually outside Sao Paulo called Mogi das Cruzes, and they'd had a lot of poltergeist activity. And I don't speak any Portuguese, and I had an interpreter, and he tells me that the people in the family in this haunted house or this activity house believed that they'd had a curse put on them by a local witch doctor, Macumbera. And as you probably know, it's a very, very, spiritualism and witchcraft is very, very active in Brazil.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
You know, you can, shops on the street corners sell you the makings, you know, for witch pie or something. Anyway,
curses.
I went to this this house, and I interviewed the police chief as well, and he told me how he, in a blank plaster wall, he'd seen flames coming out, and after a while he realized they weren't real flames, but he went and put a banknote up in among them. They didn't burn, but things were going on. And while I was there, I'm standing next to a little two-seater couch, you know, with a kind of a leatherette finish. And suddenly, three slash marks just opened up in it. I mean, they were a couple of inches apart, as if something with claws had just gone and left this two-foot-long gash or three gashes in it, you know, right next to where I was, which got my attention. Anyway.
Better that than you.
Well, that's what I thought. I did move away from it. So anyway, I got what I needed. I spoke to the family, and they brought in a witch doctor and their own Macumbera, and apparently the activity ceased. So my interpreter said, look, you know, you should really interview, you know, this Macumbera. You know, he's the guy who's lifted the curse. And I said, look, I need scientists to back this stuff up. You know, I can't have, you know, witch doctor, you know, bone through the nose. And that's going to look silly when I go back to the office and I write the story. And here's my backup. I didn't pay him his respects. Well, that night, and I was on my way back home pretty soon. So that night I was in Sao Paulo and I was having dinner. And I bit down on something, and it was a little cube of glass like you get from a broken windshield, you know?
Oh, geez.
And it was in this chicken pie that I was having.
Had you swallowed that?
No, I didn't.
I mean, had
I
you?
Oh, my
God.
And, you know, and I sort of got indignant, and the manager assured me it wasn't their fault. They bought the pies in, blah, 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 blah. So I thought, well, it's just one of those things. Didn't really think too much. And the next night, I was in hotel bar. I was in Rio the next night, getting ready to fly out the next day. And It was just about 24 hours later, and I'm in the bar, and I ordered a mixed drink, and the barman gave it to me, and I bit down in among the ice cubes. There's another cube of glass, same thing. And I couldn't believe it. And the barman showed me, he said, we have this rubber thing here that revolves and cleans. The glass wasn't chipped. I don't understand it. Have a free drink, blah, 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 blah. And I didn't really come to me yet. And I got home, back to Florida. And I did something I don't normally do. I went to the fridge and I got a Coke out. And I rarely drink sodas, but I did that night. For some reason, I poured it into a glass. And there was a tinkle. And sure enough,
same
third
thing.
Night in a row, there was another cube of glass in there. And I reckon that witch doctor just sent me a little message.
I think so, too. They were trying to tell
you something. I don't think he intended to harm me, and he certainly didn't. But he's got
well, you were
attention.
Lucky. You could have gulped it down.
I could have done. I think it would have passed.
Paul Bannister with us. His book is Tabloid Men, or Tabloid Man and the Baffling Chair of Death.
Yeah.
You have... You're in the States now, right? You live here?
Yeah, I'm here in Oregon. Yeah, yeah.
Do you see a difference between mysteries in the United Kingdom and mysteries in the United States?
Well, one difference, of course, is that they're so much older.
Oh yeah.
You know, we don't see, you know, druid ghosts here, kind of thing. But there are modern ghosts here. I've talked to people who've seen a troop of Roman soldiers, for instance, marching through the cellars of the treasurer's house in York.
Without legs, right?
It was a police officer. Harry Martindale was his name. He was working on the steam pipes, you know, in the cellar of this medieval house. It's called the treasurer's house. And he heard a noise, and a troop of 7 or 8 soldiers marched through the wall and out the other wall, and they were thigh-deep in the floor. He said that they looked really ragged, they looked very dispirited. One of them had a brass bugle-type instrument. They had a greenish kilt on, and he said they looked just like... He said, now he believes that they're Roman, but he said at the time they didn't look anything like Ben-Hur. You know, it's just a very dispirited-looking procession of ragged-looking infantrymen. And I said, thigh deep in the floor. He said, that's right. The thing went on a couple of years later. The local historical society had heard the story and went to investigate the site and found 2 archaeologists working down there. They dug up a Roman road.
Isn't that amazing?
They were marching on the surface of a road that was about 18 inches below the level of the cellar floor.
Paul, did you ever know our friend from the United Kingdom, Lionel Fanthorpe?
No, I can't say.
Great guy. I mean, just a great guy.
Yeah,
good
yeah,
storyteller.
Yeah.
He's.
It's interesting. You know, you get these connections and. You know, Guy Playfair. Perhaps heard of Guy Playfair.
Sure.
He book on the Enfield poltergeist in Britain is being made into a movie this year.
That's great.
They're calling it The Conjuring 2.
That is great. You like the psychic stories and ghost stories, don't you?
Oh, I loved them. Yeah, yeah, I loved them. I actually went to that Enfield site. It was a family there of. 4 children and a single mother. And they were under study for 7 months by the Society for Psychical Research. Playfair and Maurice Gross moved into the house and recorded just so many things it wasn't true. I went there and I walked, they were getting voices coming out. I walked in and this voice growled down my ear from nowhere. and I jumped and I said, what are you trying to do? And it said, kill you. So I said, well, you sound like a dog. I'll go and get you some Kenamite, which is a dog food. And do you know, for the whole rest of the time I was there, that thing would follow me around saying, Kenamite.
We're coming back for questions and more in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.